The news on Monday morning opens with the story of an elderly couple who starved to death in their apartment. Their landlord found them after calling to see why their rent hadn't been paid. Evidently, the couple's daughter had got mixed up with a loan shark. Her parents had spent everything they had trying to dig her out. They had been living on cat food until the cat food ran out. Every day brings another bleak austerity fairy tale like this one, and makes the pot and pan charivari of our neighbors, the zombies, sound all the louder in our ears when we cross the plaza.
Last week I have called the police,
Jürgen says, looking down through his binoculars,
and given them 10 different public order offenses these miscreants can be charged with. Still they do nothing.
Outrageous, I say. Although police indifference is perhaps not so hard to fathom. They too have had their wages cut to pay for the failed banks. Nevertheless, compared with New York and London, it's of little significance, no? There are thousands in the camps over there.
One must always clamp down on disobedience before it has a chance to take hold,
Jürgen says, then still staring out through his binoculars.
Have you noticed anything odd about Ishi's behavior lately?
Odd? I repeat. Jürgen lowers the binoculars and turns to me, his colorless eyes scanning my features like an infrared beam. She has been her usual self, I say.
Very good,
Jürgen says. Why do you ask? I say casually.
No reason.
He lifts his binoculars again.
Porter likes to be sure that all his employees are happy.
I retreat to my desk, then lowering my head so I am invisible from the windows, grab Ish by the wrist and pull her towards me.
What have you done?
What?
You didn't. A terrible thought occurs to me. You didn't say something to Blankley, did you? About Kokomoko?
Her facade of incomprehension lasts all of 10 seconds.
It was just a short email, she cries. A short, politely worded... I don't believe it.
I bury my head in my hands.
It's right in his backyard. How's that gonna look if a whole bloody island goes under in his backyard? It's got nothing to do with us. We can help. He's always saying how we can create our own reality. Isn't this exactly the kind of thing he means?
Of course it's not what he means. Blankley would drill his mother's own grave if he thought there was oil underneath it. Insofar as bankers think about nature at all, it's as the originator of the ruthless survival of the fittest model on which the market is based. If a species becomes extinct, a river runs dry, a civilization is wiped out by famine or flood or earthquake or volcano, that is usually regarded as reflecting some essential flaw in its business plan.
Ish knows that. Why is she acting like this?
Wait a second. She turns pale herself, looking at me as if she's just woken from a dream.
How did you hear about it?
Jürgen asked... Look, it's all right. As the enormity of what she has done hits her in a single wave that throws her back in her seat.
Fuck, she whispers, and then imploringly, I didn't say anything bad. I just thought he ought to know. What did Jürgen say? What's going to happen to me?
Nothing's going to happen, I say, but then frustration overtakes me again.
Didn't you think of this before? Why do you care so much about people 10,000 miles away? I don't fucking know, do I? Because maybe no one any closer will let me care about them.
My phone lights up. I am grateful for the reprieve. The caller is a man, a reporter.
My name is Ron Halsey. I work at the Record. Mr. Martingale, your name has been given to me as one of the authors of a recent report on Royal Irish Bank compiled by Agron Turabundo for the Department of Finance. Is that correct?
Yes, but I just wondered if you could expand on some of the recommendations your report makes. You advise government to inject a further 8 billion euro of direct liquidity to Royal Irish.
What?
I wondered, given the cuts that have already been made.
Wait, I advise them to what?
To, for instance, palliative care, cervical cancer vaccinations, back-to-work schemes, rehousing for at-risk minorities. Whether you had specific ideas where the next cuts should come from in order to pay for this latest bailout?
Wait, I interrupt. I didn't recommend any bailout.
I break off. Someone's tapping my shoulder. It's Rachel's secretary. Can you come upstairs? She says.
I'm on a call, I tell her.
She reaches over to the phone station and pulls the plug. The red light and all the other lights dwindle instantly into darkness. It's not actually a question, she says. Rachel is standing in her office with her back to me, gazing out the window. Sit down, Claude. I do so. On her desk, festooned in red crepe paper, is a bottle of Irish whiskey with a government harp on a label. The minister's office sent it over by way of thanks. They were extremely pleased with your work. She looks back at me over her shoulder. Perhaps that surprises you. From the press conference, it sounded as if they had ignored most of my suggestions. That's because we rewrote them, she says. A girl swoops down to land outside her window. It scrutinizes the office with an eye the same livid corpse green as the river below. After speaking to you, Jürgen had some concerns about your report's content, so before releasing it, I called it up here and went through it with him. What the department saw was the revised version. In which you advised them to continue the bailout? In which we advised that Royal Irish had a short-term liquidity issue owing to the ongoing outflow of corporate deposits and overnight funding. Nasty, but fixable. She steps away from the window and takes her seat opposite me, regarding me impassively for what seems a very long time. My figures were accurate, I say slowly. The evidence is there. Royal is finished. No amount of money will fix it. So you advised it should be wound down and its bondholders go unpaid, she says. Why should public money be used to pay off private business debts? And did you wonder at all who those bondholders could be? That did not seem pertinent. Claude, she says. At that moment, the secretary's voice issues from the phone, and Rachel roars a single, terrifying, No! Before returning affectlessly to me. Claude, we have some extremely important clients who bought heavily into Royal Irish. How do you think they would feel if they discovered that we had advised the government to let the bank go down and their investment with it? I begin to say that most of the original bondholders sold on at a loss some time ago, but she cuts me off. No, Claude, I want you to think about this. What would our clients think if we were responsible for them losing millions of euros? I clear my throat. I take your point, but the Irish government is also our client. The Irish government commissioned a single report. Yes, but to avoid a conflict, surely best practice is to... Rachel beats her fist on the desk. I told you, Claude, the best outcomes for the key players, that's what I asked you to find. Can't you read between the lines? But to pretend the bank is still alive when clearly it is not. What is wrong with you people? She exclaims. Her eyes hold mine as if she is genuinely seeking an answer. For a moment she looks terribly young, like a teacher at her wit's end with an intractable group of infants. Do you know what we are to a man like Porter Blankley, Claude? We're nothing. We're irrelevant. We're a godforsaken rock in the middle of the ocean. If we sank under the waves tomorrow, he'd barely even notice. Now, I've been trying to change his mind. I've been trying to put this place on the map, prove to him that our office can be a serious contributor to the company. And then I have one of my analysts advising government to burn our biggest client. She blinks at me as if inviting a response, but I have nothing to say. She takes a deep breath, unknots her fists, and in a more controlled voice says, Walter's built up a 25% stake in Royal Irish. Walter? Walter Corliss, Doublex. When the share price started to fall, he took the opportunity to double down. Then he doubled down again, indirectly through a broker, so nobody knew it was him. She pauses. From your reaction, I'm guessing it wasn't your idea. I'm speechless. In fact, my whole body has gone numb. At a certain level of success, it's not unusual for major clients to imagine they achieved it all by themselves. They'll dismiss their advisors, start making decisions led purely by their gut, keep going until their empires are in ruins. But Walter always seemed too smart for that, or
rather, he seemed such a monster in every other regard that I assumed he must be possessed of a sterling business sense to balance it all out.
When your report came in, I called our major clients on spec before submitting. Rachel says, that's when he told me.
How could he even afford it? A quarter of a bank?
It's in CFDs. He only needed to put down the margin, but that means now the bank's in trouble, his losses are amplified. It's already been making loans to him to cover the margin calls. If the share price falls much further, he'll be wiped out. She locks her eyes on me again. I don't need to tell you that if Dublex went under, there would be major consequences for Agrobot. Cash flow, legal, I don't even want to think about it.
And that would be the tip of the iceberg for us and for Ireland. Dublex employs thousands of people. Whole towns are built around its operations. Its implosion would make the crash to date look like a day at the races.
The government can't prop up Royal Irish indefinitely. I say, there isn't any money left.
Not indefinitely, Rachel says. I thought it might give us some time. Only now it appears someone in the Department of Finance has leaked the report to the press and they're starting to ask questions.
Yes, someone called me only a few minutes ago.
Well, you can call him back and confirm that you stand by every word, she says. After careful analysis of their accounts, you concluded blah, blah, blah. She swivels in her chair. Her face is recast in the greenish light of the terminal, giving it a submarine chill.
Be thankful we got your report before it was sent, Claude. Otherwise, we would be having a very different conversation. Take your gift. She points to the bottle of whiskey on the desk. And send up Ish. Ish isn't here. She has just left for a meeting in London and won't be back until tomorrow. I think about texting to warn her of what's in store, then decide she's better not knowing. There is nothing she can do. At least this way she can get a good night's sleep. Three more journalists call that afternoon, as well as the man from the Record. I do as I'm told, telling them that the report's recommendations are sound and that the question of how to pay for them was not part of my remit. By 4 o'clock, a picture of me at a conference 2 years ago appears on several news websites with the caption Martingale Cold or Martingale French. Later, a story runs in one of the tabloids with the headline Fat Cat Banker Who Thinks We Haven't Suffered Enough.
This fat cat thing is such bullshit, Kevin opines. Since when are bankers fat? We're in the gym like every day.
Criticize if you want, but at least be accurate. Jocelyn agrees.
When you think of what they could have said, you know, crazy frog says let them eat cake, that sort of thing.
It's just lazy journalism, Jocelyn says.
Coincidentally, Walter calls too in order to rant about some regulatory hold-up or other. I can't concentrate on what he's saying. It takes all of my restraint not to break in on him and bellow, you told me you didn't have a holding in Royal Irish. You told me. But maintaining these charades is what professionalism means, and anyway, when I investigate, I find that the arcane derivative he used to make the investment means that he didn't actually own anything, but instead was making a kind of leveraged bet on shares held by a broker-dealer. So technically, he was telling the truth. The market's lending to the government's lending to Royal, Royal's lending to Walter to cover Walter's own stake in Royal, pulled ever downwards by the market. I draw a diagram on a scrap of paper, trying to work it all out, but very quickly it turns into a self-devouring incomprehensibility, an Ouroboros of debt, like the black twin of Ish's cooler ring. I ask Jürgen what will happen next.
Rachel is trying to persuade Walter to get rid of his holding before the market finds out about it and the Royal Irish black hole becomes a much larger and more dangerous Royal Irish Dublex black hole,
Jürgen says.
The problem is that Walter is still under the impression that Royal is about to bounce back.
Magical thinking. An invaluable quality for an entrepreneur until it isn't. But Walter... Jürgen shrugs.
Walter is a person. People do irrational things. They act according to the stories they want to hear instead of the reality.
He cocks his head, a mechanical bird.
Where's Ish?
I leave the office early. Ariadne waves to me from the window of the Ark. I remember she wanted to speak to me about her problems with the rent, but I feel contaminated after the Dublex revelation, so I just wave and pass on. At home, I turn on the news only to find myself faced, as though the broadcaster were coming directly from my conscience, with the minister again. haggard and worn, reciting the findings of the faked report like some poisonous spell whose consequences he has no conception of. When the phone rings, my first dreadful thought is that the journalists have somehow got my mobile number. But this time, the caller is Paul. William O'Hara has emailed him to confirm our place on the guest list for his public interview with Banerjee at the Black and White Festival.
"It's 2 weeks on Thursday," he says. "So time to get moving."
"Excellent," I say.
"Excellent. So when are you coming over?"
"You want me to come over?"
"I thought you said you were going to help,"
Paul returns a little sharply.
"Yes, although I meant in the way of providing background detail, moral support, that sort of thing."
"Oh, I see. So basically you're saying I have to do it all by myself."
"Aren't novels usually written this way?"
A sigh crackles from the receiver.
"This isn't a novel, Claude. It's a proposal. I've got a few ideas, but I want to bounce them off someone first."
"Bounce them off someone?" The phrase reassures me. It suggests there will be little more required of me than a physical presence. I can be a presence, and a bout of artistic creativity might be just the kind of activity I need to purge the noxious taste of my day. I set out, trying not to think about Dublex and its shaky foundations, trying not to see in the streets and faces I encounter a reality that has been secretly changed, the first imperceptible marks of a new and lessened future. I concentrate instead on novelistic details, fruits stacked in the grocery, the stooped old woman casting breadcrumbs to the pigeons, a convoy of robed priests climbing aboard a bus. The rain has been falling all day. It seems a whole sea must have spilled from the sky. The swollen river lowers like a drunkard disturbed from his sleep. Clogged gutters quickly become filthy lakes, over which pedestrians skip and dance and hop with grim grey faces as in some totalitarian musical. On Paul Street, the weather has driven almost everyone indoors, though a couple of men make do with a sheet of polyurethane beneath which they share a dog end like doughty Tommies in a Passchendaele trench. Paul, when he answers the door, has a twitchy demeanour I haven't seen before.
"Let's get to it," he says. "Klitz is going out in a minute, so we'll have a couple of hours totally free."
"Volleyball?"
"Yes, they're in the quarterfinals. Nearly there, eh?"
"Good for them," I say ingenuously while a surge of rain strikes the window in a mocking minor chord.
"Okay, down to business," he says, directing me to sit at the kitchen table.
Instantly, Remington detaches himself from the television.
"What are you doing, Daddy?"
"We're writing a story," Paul says. "Now be quiet."
"Is it a story about an ant?"
"No."
"Is it a story about an ant who goes all around the world and then comes back and he lives in a matchbox and his name is Roland?"
"Go and watch your cartoons," Paul says, gripping the boy by the shoulders and shunting him back towards the television. "That's an order."
With a little sigh, Remington picks up the remote. A torrent of explosions, strobes, and rainbows fragmenting into hissing diamonds blasts from the TV like ECT with product placement.
"Okay, okay."
Paul seems considerably tenser than usual. He picks up a plastic biro, chews the end, then sets it down again.
"The thing is," he says, "I don't think this is going to work."
Clearly my role here is going to be more involved than I expected.
"It's just a proposal," I tell him in a calming voice. "And you already have most of it in what you told Dodson at the party."
"Well, that's just it, Claude." He looks up at me with eyes that are flashing vortices of anxiety.
"Anal analyst. What is that? You know?"
"Well, it is just as you said, a working title. Obviously, you will not use anal in the actual book." He shakes his head vigorously.
"Anal's not the issue. Anal is fine. The problem is analyst. Who wants to read about an analyst? Who knows what an analyst even is?"
"I know what an analyst is, I can tell you."
"You've already told me. You've told me what you do 10 times and I forget it straight away. It's like it's too boring to be retained by the human mind."
"Can't you make it interesting? Isn't that your job?"
"Within reason. But I need some kind of story. I need something to happen. Today, for example. Tell me what you did today."
I flinch inwardly. His eyes fix on me, enormous gibbous, like the eyes of some nocturnal animal peering out of the forest. In them, as if from a hidden camera, I see myself at Rachel's desk, promising to lie about the phony report.
I developed a financial model of a notional amalgam of the three main Irish banks, I say.
That's what I mean. No one wants to read about some guy going around developing financial models.
Dudson wanted to. He said it sounded bold.
Bold is code for no one's going to buy that. Look, I've made my decision, the analyst out. So what we're left with is anal. Igor and I talked through a few ideas earlier today. See if anything jumps out at you.
Placing a pair of reading glasses on his nose, he frowns down at the notebook.
Anal amateurs. The comic tale of two medical students as they attempt to raise the money for college by opening their own unorthodox proctology clinic. 18 and anal. The battle of an uptight young man to shake off his authoritarian upbringing. 24-hour red-hot anal. In Finland, the land of the midnight sun, a local blacksmith's decision to open a colonic irrigation center causes tension in the old community.
I will be honest, I think you are going down the wrong path with these anal themes.
But we told Dodson that it was called Anal Analyst,
Bull remonstrates.
That's the idea he wanted to hear about. We've already scrapped the analyst. If we chuck anal too, what's left? You want me to hand him a pile of blank pages? Publishers won't pay money for blank pages, Claude. I've tried it and they won't.
Before I can reply, what can I possibly say? The bathroom door flies open. Like a goddess emerging from a volcano, Clitia steps out in a billow of steam. She is wearing boots of white patent leather that climb up above her knee, leaving perhaps 12 scandalous inches of thigh exposed between them and the hem of her miniskirt, which is also white and also patent leather.
I am going to volleyball, she says deadpan, but then raising her voice abruptly. What is this?
What's what? Paul turns to follow her pointing finger.
Oh, for God's sake, Remington, what's in your mouth?
What?
Comes the unconvincing reply.
Is that the plug from the TV?
I was trying to make myself electric,
Remington explains in a small voice.
Can't you even take care of him for 5 minutes? Clitia rails. How can I go out if I get dressed you to watch him?
He was chewing a plug, that's all, Paul protests. It's not like he had his fingers in the socket.
He's like the less you do, the lazier you get, she says.
He'll be late for your game, he says shortly.
Huh, she says.
She goes to the door where, rather desultorily, she slings over her shoulder the worn nylon sports bag.
I am leaving, she says.
Okay, fine. But she doesn't leave. Instead, she hovers by the door, examining us where we sit at the table.
What are you doing?
Nothing.
Chasing again the waitresses?
Yeah, that's right.
Daddy's writing a story,
Remington sings from the floor.
A story?
She looks from me to her husband and back.
You didn't tell her?
I say to Paul.
Tell me what?
Paul flurries a hand impatiently.
It's nothing.
We ran into my old editor last week and we're trying to put together a proposal for him. It probably won't come to anything.
He was very interested in seeing something new, I tell her.
Oh, she says. She looks surprised.
Have a good game, Paul says.
Yes, she says. Her imperious facade seems to waver, then she gathers herself.
Bye, Mama,
the little boy calls. The door closes and we hear her clop away down the hall.
Why didn't you tell her you met Dodson?
I ask. Oh, God, Claude, she's been through that ringer so many times. What's the point of putting her through it again? When we don't even have anything concrete.
So let's make something concrete, I exhort him. I think we dismissed the alienated banker too quickly. Think about it. The reasons you want to throw it away aren't those, in fact, its strengths. He's boring. His life is boring. Isn't that the point? Isn't that what makes his story true? He's the modern man. He lives to work. He has everything anyone could want. Or rather, he has enough money to buy anything anyone could want. Yet his life is empty. And then he meets this beautiful waitress.
The key turns in the door. Clitia, grimacing, comes limping into the apartment.
Paul jumps up, hurries to assist her.
What happened?
I come out of building, my foot slip on curb.
She sinks into a chair, massages her ankle.
All these stairs, I think I never make it.
You should have called me,
Paul reproves her, bringing some ice from the kitchen.
You think it's sprained?
She sighs stoically.
I'm sure it's fine. Maybe I rest him for a little while.
She casts a sidelong glance at the notebook on the table. How is story going? Oh, Christ, don't ask. Paul says, it's actually going quite well, I tell her.
You should use the green crayon, Daddy,
Remington says, proffering a box.
It's a better colour for stories.
Have you had your bath yet? Clitzia says.
I don't need a bath.
Paul protests that she should stay off her feet, but Clitzia insists that she already feels better now that she has taken her boots off. She leads Remington towards the bathroom.
But I want to show Daddy the other good crayons,
he says. Daddy's working, she replies, and the ghost of a smile crosses her lips. It takes all evening, but at last I persuade him to give the banker another shot. We draw up a list of supporting characters. He promises he will call me early next week when he has a rough idea of the plot, the basic mechanisms by which our everyman is brought together with the woman who will transform him. Ish is back in the office the following afternoon. She is in good humor, cracking jokes, flirting with clients, apparently with no idea that her fate hangs in the balance. But she is the only one. Bankers, beneath the facade of reason, are as superstitious as sailors, with a preternatural sensitivity to bad luck. Her colleagues might not know what exactly she's done, but they can tell something's up, and the whole research department gives her a wide berth. Eyes track her from behind every terminal, then vanish as she draws near. When face-to-face contact is unavoidable, they try to keep at least one dividing wall between them and wince anticipatorily, as if a bolt of lightning might descend and incinerate her at any moment. But the lightning bolt doesn't come. Not that afternoon, not the next morning. As we slip into afternoon with no word from the uncanny valley, I begin to allow myself to hope. Maybe Rachel changed her mind, or maybe I imagined the whole thing. Maybe she doesn't know about the email to Blankley. Maybe Jürgen was just making a general inquiry. Hey, Claude, you're on TV! I look up. There I am on the plaza explaining to a journalist why it is a very good thing that the government is giving the last of its money to a failed bank.
I never noticed how big your head was before,
Jocelyn Lockhart says.
Or your fucking accent, Gary McCrum says. It's so French.
Oh, shit. Ish says. She is looking into her computer. It's as if I can hear her go pale. She turns to me with eyes like moons and says in a hoarse whisper,
just got a mail from Rachel. She wants me to go up for a chat.
Oh? I try to sound casual.
What do you think it means?
I stroke my chin.
Well,
probably she just wants to see how you are. Talk about life generally, you know, a chat.
That woman's never had a chat in her life,
Ish says. Her face is like a ghost's. The fake tan somehow makes her look paler still.
Christ, you reckon it's about that email? Am I going to get canned?
Of course not, I say firmly. You are a valued member of the team.
Oh, God,
she says and covers her face with her hands. As soon as the lift door closes over her, I run to the department head's office. I don't fucking know, Claude, Liam English says. She dropped the fucking ball in a major way. We're in the middle of not one but two giant takeovers and she's writing the CEO letters like my fucking 8-year-old asking Santa Claus to save the rainforest. He tugs furiously on his electronic cigarette, sends coils of vapor ghosting over his head. It's not just the fucking impudence of it. We're borrowed up to her tits to pull these deals off. We don't want anything happening that'll give our backers the heebie-jeebies. And here's Ish trying to get us to carry the can for global fucking warming. What if the press got hold of that email? Bank drowns primitive island race. How's that gonna fucking look?
Isn't it possible that helping Kokomoko could bring some good publicity? I plead. You know, banks have had a lot of bad press, but here's one doing something positive, ready to act ethically.
Liam sits back in his chair, looks at me square in the eye until I feel my will buckle and collapse. As I return to my desk, I catch Kevin tracking me, calculating what's just happened, how much it's damaged me, the best means of taking advantage.
Facts for you, Claude,
Kimberly says, clipping in from reception. I take the paper from her hand. There is no text. It is a solid block of blackness. What is this?
That's how it came out, she says, shrugging. But with your name on the top.
I stare at the page. It reminds me eerily of the painting I saw in William O'Hara's house, some deathly message coiled just beneath its surface.
Looks like someone's marked your cards, Clodo,
Gary says without looking away from his screen.
Bollocks, it's just some student trying to use up her ink supply,
Jocelyn says.
Look out, capitalism, Gary says.
The lift doors open. I spin round in my chair just as Ish emerges. No security guards with her, that's a good sign. Yet she looks shell-shocked, grey as ashes, her eyes wide but focused on nothing.
Are you all right? What happened?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure?
Ish begins to speak, then glancing up realizes that everyone in the office is staring at her with a kind of appreciative mystification, as if 5 minutes previously they'd seen her jump out the window. Tugging my sleeve, she leads me into the lobby.
Rachel was livid about that email. She says, you'd think I'd send Blankley a photocopy of my arse.
But she didn't. You're not...
She was going to, I have no fucking doubt. But then in the middle of everything, Howie called.
Howie?
Yeah, he phoned down and insisted he be put through to her, there and then. So she listens to him for a couple of minutes, barely says a word herself. Next thing you know, she's sending me back downstairs, telling me in the future to keep her in the loop.
What loop?
From what she said, it sounded like the island was part of some ATCM investment strategy.
ATCM? Howie's fund? The more she tells me, the more confused I am.
She says if I clarified that with her, none of this would be an issue.
Wait, Howie's fund is going to invest in Kokomoko?
This is like hearing that Hitler has deployed the Waffen-SS to build an owl sanctuary.
That's what he told her. I mean, I presume he just made it up to get me off the hook.
She is calling his mobile, but there is no answer.
Fuck it, she says. I'm going to find out what's going on.
What about the Chinese wall?
I say, but she has already charged off up the stairs to Agron Torabundo Credit Management. The factotum who answers the door is not pleased to see us.
You can't be up here, he scolds.
Ish just pushes past him. The factotum throws his hands in the air, then promptly vanishes, leaving us to find our own way. Life is very different here on the 9th floor. There are paintings on the walls and fresh flowers on every flat surface. Operatives zip back and forth in loafers and chinos, exuding an air of easeful mastery that is a million miles from the feverish hamster wheeling of the research area, to say nothing of the bellowing chaos of the trader's den. The only discordant note is struck by the two men sitting squeezed into a comically small and ornate chaise longue, burly, lumpen characters with a single eyebrow between them furrowed menacingly at anyone who happens to look their way.
Ish!
Howie is standing in an office doorway, waving his arm at us as if from the top deck of a yacht. To one side of him, an astonishingly tall and beautiful woman is helping a stubby, mustachioed man into a camel-hair coat. Whatever has happened in the office, the stubby man seems very pleased about it. He shakes Howie's hand and takes his leave. The burly men rise and button their jackets.
Make yourselves at home, Howie
says, beckoning us in. The office is enormous, with an enormous monitor and an enormous view of the mountains. On the enormous desk sits a hold-all filled with banknotes. Are we interrupting something?
New client, Howie
says. He zips the bag closed. A moment later, the beautiful woman returns and takes it from his hand. She looks a little like one of the dancers from Velvet Dreams. Her attire, extremely high heels, metallic microskirt, huge hoop earrings, might comfortably be described as unsecretarial.
Xenia, babes, I'm not taking any calls for the next few minutes, okay?
Howie tells her. She trembles doubtfully on the threshold, then turns away, pronouncing his words silently to herself as if trying to keep them in her head.
Sex alphabet.
Ish mouths to me. Howie slides into his seat and smiles expansively.
So the two of you have practically given Rachel a prolapse, he says. That deserves a drink.
Fishing under his desk, he produces a bottle and three glasses.
You heard the Secretary of the U.S. Treasury was onto her about Royal Irish.
The U.S. Treasury?
I repeat.
In Washington?
Very, very concerned that nobody loses money, Howie says, pouring out three-finger measures of single malt and passing them to us.
Meaning Walter,
I say.
Meaning Danforth, Howie says. Danforth deep into them.
What's Royal Irish got to do with the US Treasury?
He says.
And what's Walter got to do with Royal Irish? And Danforth?
Ask Crazy Frog here. His report was all set to nuke the lot of them.
Ish turns to me questioningly, but I don't reply. I have no idea how Danforth could be involved in Royal Irish. I'm feeling increasingly like the whole day is one ongoing dream.
I don't know what they're getting so roiled up about.
Howie says, the minister's not making the decisions anymore, so your report's pretty much irrelevant anyway. But you know the Americans, they want every box ticked. Cheers.
We return the toast circumspectly. The exuberant burn of the whiskey seems exactly wrong for this time and situation.
So I just met Rachel,
Ish says.
Yeah.
Howie yelps with laughter.
Jesus, Ish. Asking Porter to save a bunch of cavemen in the middle of the Pacific. What were you thinking? Did you have your period or something?
How did he find out? Ish asks in a small, flat voice.
Blankly, you should have heard him. Who does this little bitch think she is? I'll piss those fucking monkeys underwater myself.
He laughs to himself.
Well, anyway, I managed to sort it out. Just don't send him any more emails, seriously, even if the Earth's about to crash into the sun.
Thanks, Ish says meekly, chafing her legs together like a little girl.
No problem,
Howie says.
What did he say to him?
The opulent smile again, dripping diamonds.
I told him you were irreplaceable,
which is the truth. Rachel said something about you investing in Kokomoko.
Yeah,
Howie chuckles. That was BS, right?
Nope, that was true too,
Howie says, and then,
well, well, look who's out of his box.
Grisha's eyeing us warily from the doorway. He's lost weight and gained deep rings around his eyes. In his filthy clothes, he looks like a defrocked Rasputin chained up in some dungeon of the mind.
What are you doing here, Ivan? Smelled a pretty lady, did you?
Sticking close to the wall, Grisha sidles in and hovers behind us, a blurred darkness like an unexplained shadow.
I'm just telling Ish about phase two,
Howie says to him. Grisha only grunts.
I take the bait.
Phase two?
It's still in development. We haven't thought of a name for it yet, probably Gaia or Ecofund or something like that.
What's it got to do with the island?
Ish asks, and only someone who knew her well would pick up the trace of dread in her voice.
To get Porter and Rachel off the warpath.
Howie stretches back, putting his arms behind his head.
I had to persuade them that you were doing a nixer for me, and that this island of yours had something to do with the fun, which, let me tell you, was not easy. I mean, it's got no infrastructure, no exports, no educated workforce. Plus, there's the small matter that it's about to be buried by a tidal wave. Very difficult to pass it off as a business venture. But then it hit me.
Maybe that's the point.
He pauses dramatically, and it strikes me, just as it did on the hotel balcony that night, that this is a performance. But I can't tell what kind. I can't tell whether he believes what he's saying, or even whether he wants us to believe it. How is it the point? I say at last.
I'm glad you asked me that, Crazy. Now, you two might want to hold on to your seats, because this is some heady stuff. So, I told you before about how our little fund here operates. That's by using a lot of very, very complicated maths. Grisha's established a financial instrument that can essentially reverse the polarity of losses, meaning that if you invest with us, you're guaranteed to make money. Which in today's uncertain investment climate is an attractive proposition, and we've been doing pretty well for a couple of greenhorns, haven't we, Grisha?
Grisha doesn't reply, just blazes darkly by the door.
Until now, we've been using the instrument defensively as a safeguard. This losses to profits operation isn't just a matter of changing minuses into pluses, after all, it's a difficult process. But for a while now, we've been looking at other options, other ways to maximize our returns. None of them seemed quite right, and then you came along with your island, and everything just fell into place.
He drains his whiskey, pours himself a fresh measure.
This is actually very good,
he notes.
The island, Ish presses.
Oh yeah, so I thought to myself, what if instead of using the instrument as a backup, we used it offensively? You'll remember Wall Street did that with credit default swaps. First they used them to insure their own loans against default, and then they started using them to bet on other people's loans defaulting.
What if we started deliberately targeting losing propositions, sank our money into investments we knew were going to fail that no one else would touch? Could we use providential antinomies to turn those losses into profits so that the worse something did, the more we'd make?
Wait,
Ish says in a high, strained voice.
Are you talking about investing in the island because it's going to sink?
I'm talking about going beyond the counterintuitive. Howie's voice shrugs off its ironic mantle, takes on an oracular resonance. I'm talking about monetizing failure. If you could do that, what would it mean?
But that is pure alchemy. I say monetizing failure.
It's completely irrational. I can't understand how such a thing could be possible. Of course you can't. You're not a mathematical genius. And much as I like you, Claude, you'll understand if I don't tell you our secret formula. You know what something like that is worth? As it is, we've got to keep Grisha here under lock and key. Good thing he doesn't like going outside. Right, Grisha?
The Russian smiles an empty smile. Ish shakes her head, wilts back in her chair like a flower sprayed with a toxin.
Genius or not, no one's going to invest in something they know will lose money.
I say, it's like asking them to throw their savings in a fire.
You're right about that, crazy.
Howie commends me with a whiskey glass.
Getting people on board, that's the drawback.
But say to start out, we don't pick something utterly hopeless. Instead, we come up with something that could theoretically turn a book. For instance, we put a golf course on the island.
And a 5-star hotel.
A golf course?
Ish repeats in a half shriek.
Well, sure. It's all right there in your email. The rolling meadows, the sand dunes, all that. It's perfect.
But the island's tiny.
Ish protests.
And the meadows are where the islanders graze their goats.
In fairness, people aren't going to travel thousands of miles to see a bunch of goats, Howie says. Anyway, the point is that this time round it's the investment proper that's the insurance. See, if the big wave never comes, we can make money from the hotel. A conventional return, call it. But if the wave does come, as seems statistically likely, and if the island goes under with our investment, that's when we really cash in. Call that, with a bow to me, your irrational return.
Neither Ish nor I speak. She is pinned back in her chair, eyes huge, as if she has witnessed an atrocity.
Come on, guys, show some enthusiasm. Howie half laughs, half shouts. Don't you see the bottom line here? Even when it all goes tits up, you still get paid. Profit is finally liberated from circumstance. It's the Holy Grail. It's the singularity.
It's madness, I say.
The investors don't think it's madness, Claude. Howie shakes his head. That last meeting I had, he gestures towards the door, the stubby man with the moustache recently exited. He's put in $1 million in it. $1 million of his own money for something that doesn't even have a name yet.
Then he is mad too.
Maybe it sounds mad now, but that's because you're ignoring the existing information. The smart investor knows that in a few years from now, there aren't going to be any more conventional profits. What's on the cards for Ish's little island isn't a one-off. This is just the beginning.
You're talking about global warming?
I'm talking about the whole fucking shooting match, Claude. Seizures in the electricity grid, degradation of ecosystems, the spread of epidemics, the disintegration of the financial system. They're all part of the same phenomenon. Civilization has become a bubble. When it pops, it's going to be very, very messy. Even in the best case scenario, no one's going to make a cent for 300 years unless they can work out how to make loss pay.
But that means profiting from human misery.
Two bright spots have appeared on Ish's cheeks.
Profiting from conditions we did nothing to create,
Howie says.
What's wrong with that?
Obviously it's fucking wrong, Howie. How's anything going to get better if your stupid fund pays out every time there's a humanitarian disaster?
I don't understand why you're getting so emotional, he says. It's maths, that's all. It's a new mathematical model according to which capital will no longer be adversely affected by developments in the non-banking world. How can that be a bad thing?
Because we live in the non-banking world. The non-banking world is the world, don't you get it? What's the point of making millions if in a few years the whole planet will be underwater?
Howie just looks at her with the dumb, bestial eyes of a lamb. Ish emits a furious gurgle, then jumps to her feet and stamps out of the room.
You're welcome,
Howie says. Grisha chuckles approvingly.
Okay, Ivan, off you go, Howie tells him. Still chuckling, the Russian lurches out. Christ, he gives me the fucking creeps. Howie says, I don't think he's washed once since he got here. I take a last sip of my whiskey and rise to my feet.
I should get back too, I say. This has been very entertaining. Between ourselves, though, you don't honestly believe it can work, do you?
Howie laughs. I'm just giving people what they want, Claude. That's all I ever try to do.
You think this is what they want? To invest in catastrophe?
Of course it is. A great big flood's coming. We've got the lifeboat. An ark for the chosen few where they can relax with a martini, watch everybody else drown. It's exactly what they want. It's what they've wanted their whole lives.
But this... I gesture around me at the computer, the office, the rooms and staff beyond, the external manifestations of the fund. It's not an ark. It isn't anything. It's a fiction, a fairy tale.
We're in the business of fairy tales, Claude.
He swirls his glass a moment, then says,
Did you know I started in stats? That was my undergraduate degree. In my final year, I did a paper on salaries to performance ratios in the City of London. One of the big five banks let me and a couple of friends come in and analyse the track record of their best traders. We spent a month going through 5 years of figures. The stocks they picked, the hits, the misses, the money they'd made and the money they'd lost. What we found was that a random selection would have given better results than their picks. 1 year one guy might be lucky, another year another might be lucky. But year on year consistency was close to zero. Meaning that if you'd pulled the stocks out of a hat or had a monkey pick them by throwing darts at a board, in the long run, you would have done better. Anyhow, we go to the bank's chief financial officer with our findings. We're expecting they'll cause a stir. If there is nothing more to it than blind chance, then the bank's whole trading operation is a sham. So yeah, we're pretty excited. And the CFO listens and he says it's a very interesting study. That night, he has one of his minions take us out on the piss. Cocktails, strippers, the whole bit. And then we go back to college and that's the end of that. Except that when I finish my degree, I find I can't get a job in London for love nor money. No one in the square mile will touch me. Not to clean the fucking toilets. So it's back to the Emerald Isle with my tail between my legs.
He smiles up at me. I gaze back at him, not understanding.
It's meaningless, Claude. All of this, he says, flicking a hand at the window. And all of this, tapping the Bloomberg. And everything you do and everything everyone like you does all day long in cities around the world, it's meaningless.
You don't have the information to predict what the future will bring. Yes, you think you can make an educated guess. This whole trillion-dollar industry is predicated on the belief that clever men can make educated guesses, but it's an illusion. In actuality, your educated guesses are just pissing in the wind, statistically speaking.
He rotates his tumbler on the glass-topped desk. I guess the good news for us, he says, is that people like illusions. They like strong narratives. They like good stories. The one about the brilliant CEO who makes tough decisions and turns the company around. The one about the clever man in the very expensive suit whose penetrating analysis can tell if the share price will go up or down. Even now, when everybody's out for our blood, they still want to believe that we've got the answers, that someone's got the answers. They'd rather believe that than the truth.
He tosses back his whiskey.
In fact, that's about the one sure bet you can make. If it's a choice between a difficult truth and a simple lie, people will take the lie every time, even if it kills them.
Halfway down the stairs, I find Ish sitting on a step. From above, I can see dark roots growing through her blonde hair. I'm about to tell her what Howie more or less admitted, that phase two is a mirage, a trap for unwary investors, that nothing will come of it. But was that what he said? When I revisit the scene of only a moment ago, I find it has already become shifting, elusive, uncertain, as though the conversation had contained some hidden application, some proprietary software that now acts to shut down any memory of it, every detail, large and small, vanishing out of my mind even as I watch. She wipes her eyes perfunctorily.
What's this about, Walter? She says.
Reluctantly, I tell her about the concealed stake in Royal, the rewritten report.
Fucking hell, she says, shaking her head.
Outside, night is setting in. Across the river, the floors of the unoccupied office blocks fluoresce, 1,000 cold fires blazing for no one.
I wish Rachel had fired me, Ish says. Then I wouldn't have had to find out about any of this.
I would have felt like I'd done something noble instead of helping Howie turn the end of the world into a cash cow.
It's not as bad as you think.
It is. It's worse. Actual people are going to be affected by this. People who don't know what a derivative is. People who don't even have bank accounts. They're going to wake up one morning and find they're not able to buy food because some genius 5,000 miles away has found a new way to game the system.
It won't work. It can't. It doesn't make any sense.
Nothing we do makes sense. Doesn't seem to stop it.
She turns to look at me. What kind of people are we, Claude?
Like, what kind of people are we?
None of this is your fault.
I don't know about that.
If Howie hadn't thought of it, someone else would. You were trying to help, that's all.
She snuffles, blows out her cheeks, then lets out a single bark of a laugh. I did have my period, she says.
Excuse me?
When I sent the email to Porter, and Howie was saying I must have had my period to do something so emotional and mad, I did have it.
It's not emotional and mad to want to help people, I tell her. But she doesn't reply, just gazes out at the scraps of light on the river as they glister and disappear into the blue-black opacity of the night.
4. King Tide. This sucker could go down. George W. Bush. The minister dies next morning. I'm taking a call when I see the news flash up on the terminal. Reflexively, I stand to check the big screen mounted on the wall. All around the office, my colleagues do likewise, popping up over the dividers like so many Italian-suited meerkats. The announcement is followed by a lavish package of biography and tributes clearly put together weeks before. Pictures of the minister as a child, sitting on a donkey in knickerbockers, rasping footage of him as an ambitious young TD, fellow politicos voicing the usual saccharine platitudes.
Poor cunt, Jocelyn says. Maybe now they'll appoint somebody competent. Brent Crude Kelleher says.
Jürgen watches, arms folded, from the back of the room. Even when the obit comes to the Royal Irish scandal and the controversial report, he remains utterly impassive. The market is equivocal about the minister's death. The financial news is dominated instead by yet another banking scandal. A trader in a Parisian bank has embezzled an as-yet-unknown number of millions from a client account.
He was on the Delta One desk at Pécuchet, but he started out in the back office and knew all the security codes, Joe Piston says. Sneaked in at night when all the drones had got home, forged a whole load of documents signing the client's money over to himself.
Wow, old school, says Kevin.
On the screen, a bewildered-looking man in a black suit and black tie is being led in handcuffs to a police van.
The French press are calling him Piero, Joe says, because he's all in black. The famous French sense of humour. Jocelyn says.
How much did he take?
I ask.
Not a huge amount originally. 10 million or so from a mutual fund. They hadn't even noticed. It was the crazy trades he was making with it that got him busted when internal compliance finally woke up.
€10 million.
Kevin nudges me joshingly.
That'd buy a lot of frog's legs, eh, Claude?
The news lifts everybody's spirits, partly schadenfreude, partly bankly superstition, the belief that at any given time there are only a limited number of bad things that can happen, which if they've already happened to someone else, therefore can't happen to you. I try to use it to break the ice with Ish, who ever since the Howie episode has been monosyllabic. This rogue trader will hurt Pécuchet, I say.
Good on him, she says. She's glowering into her computer as if attempting to destroy it telepathically.
Good on him for stealing €10 million, I repeat.
Yeah.
And losing it all on futile bets.
Yeah.
Money that was enough to build a whole school that instead goes up in smoke.
Oh yeah, like they were going to use 1 cent of it to build schools.
Well, they were not just going to throw it away.
You're right, Claude. They were going to use it to add a few more inches to some squillionaire's fucking money mountain so he could stand on top of it, waving his dick at everybody below. That's what they were going to do. That's all any of us ever do.
I think about this, rocking gently in my chair. Ish hammers at her keyboard, ignoring the lights on her phone.
Is everything all right? I say.
I don't know what I'm doing here anymore, she blurts. I feel like a prostitute. Worse than a prostitute. I mean, at least prostitutes have the excuse of really needing the money.
But you do need the money, I say, for your mortgage.
I intend it as a consolation, but that is not how it sounds.
A little later, Jürgen appears, descending in a kind of hail of false heartiness.
"Claude, Claude, Claude," he says, clapping me on the shoulder. "How is everything, Claude? What are you working on at the moment?"
I explain that in anticipation of more fallout from Pécuchet, I'm changing from a neutral to a sell recommend on several continental banks, then tail off. Jürgen is not listening. Instead, he is merely nodding vacantly while staring over my shoulder at my terminal. "Are you looking for something?" I ask.
Me?
He says innocently, now scrutinizing the documents on my desk. Are you spying on me?
Of course not,
he says, and then, what areas specifically did you think I was spying on?
What's going on?
I snap upright in my chair.
Nothing, Jürgen assures me. Except that HR has confirmed you used to work in the back office, like Pécuchet's road trader did.
That was years ago. I protest, in a different bank, in a different country. I have never even been in the BOT back office.
Exactly,
he agrees.
So it is safe to say you are not embezzling funds from your present clients.
Are you seriously asking me this?
It has come down from compliance, Jürgen says apologetically. Everyone with a back office history is being checked across the whole bank.
That's ridiculous, he says. Claude's as straight as a die. He won't even take sugar home from the canteen.
Jürgen's interrogative gaze swivels onto her.
Sugar sachets are company property, he says.
You have my word, I have not been embezzling, forging, or making unauthorized trades, I say.
That is good enough for me, Claude.
Again, he pats my shoulder.
However, you will need to take your hard drive just to make sure.
He motions over to men in black t-shirts who set about detaching plugs and cables and finally lift my terminal off the desk.
Is this absolutely necessary?
Phone,
one of them says to me, holding out his hand. How am I supposed to work?
It won't take long,
Jürgen promises.
This fucking place,
Ish says when they have finished. I swear, as soon as I get my next bonus, I am gone. Right, I say.
I mean it this time.
I dig out some old paperwork and spread it over my denuded desk, but I am too furious to do anything. I turn to the TV. It is showing a report from Oran, where an airstrike on rebel positions is believed to have secured the region at last. A clip of the Caliph and the British XPM smiling together, ringed by Imperial guards, is followed by shots of smoking wasteland, weeping women, charred body parts. Oil prices have stabilized following the news, a voice tells us. I get up, go to the window. The rain is pouring down interminably, turning the world into thin, shifting vertical bands like monochrome ribbons, as if the whole day's been fed into the shredder. Where is Ariadne? I think with a pang. And where is Paul? Has he given up on me? Did he decide the banker was unsalvageable after all, even in fiction?
Call for you, Claude, Kimberly says.
The voice on the line is heavily accented and sounds upset. It takes me a moment to identify it as Clitzia's.
He got a review, she says.
Paul? I'm confused. For the proposal?
For clown, she says. Some idiot on Aperon. He's going crazy. Please, Frenchman, you must come.
I fetch my tablet from the apartment so I can read the review in the taxi. Posted last night by someone styling himself Wombat Willie, it is headed "A Fiasco is Not a Circus" and consists of a long list of criticisms which includes, though is not limited to, the unfunniness of the clown, incorrect inspection procedures followed by the health and safety officer, the implausible ending, in which Bobo saves Timmy from a subdural hematoma by performing a one-man show that keeps him laughing until the ambulance arrives. Show me one medical textbook that says this. And the misleading comparison on the jacket copy to Bimal Banerjee's The Clowns of Sorrow. He also notes that the book was delivered 2 days late, and that he got a paper cut taking it out of the box before giving it a rating of 2 thistles and a swastika. Strange, bestial noises can be heard as I come up the corridor.
Daddy's writing his book,
Remington tells me as he lets me in. Is that right? A loud crash issues from somewhere behind him.
I'm writing a book too, look!
He hands me a sheet of paper on which he has scrawled Remington, Remington, Rememinson, and other variants in crayon.
Very good. Is your mother... Ah!
Klitsia, in a dressing gown, comes out of the nursery with a phone to her ear.
Because I can't,
she is saying. Her expression is anguished, and there are tears in her eyes.
I just can't. Maybe next week. I have to go.
She rings off, looks up at me exhaustedly.
Thanks for coming, she says. I didn't know who else I can call.
That's all right. A bellowing comes from the bedroom, followed by a series of thuds.
When did he see the review?
An hour ago, but this whole week he's acting strange, not sleep, not eat, walking around, talking to himself. Then he sees this internet and...
All right, don't worry.
I knock on the bedroom door, then enter. A Louis XIV chair lies on its side. Many of the towers of books are now scattered on the floor.
What's the point, Claude?
Paul cries on seeing me.
You work and you slave for years, you make sacrifices and put your family through hell just to get it in the neck from some guy calling himself Wombat Willie.
Klitsia is right. He looks quite disturbed. His hair, clothes, even eyebrows are askew, as in some allegorical figure of frazzlement.
Why should you care what Wombat Willie thinks? I cajole. This is just one person who we know nothing about. He could be a fanatical racist or a chronic masturbator, or maybe he is a she, an enormously fat, and for years she has not left her house, which she shares with her 8 cats, also enormously fat.
Pretty sure it's a he,
Paul says morosely.
I looked up his other reviews. He gave a lightning bolt and a Buckingham Palace to the Phillips for him body shave. He called it the gold standard of ball hair removal.
That just proves my point, I say. You're an artist. You can't be dictated to by the market. Do you think if he were writing today, Shakespeare would care if he got only 1.5 pineapples for Hamlet? Or 3 smiley faces for Romeo and Juliet? Do you think James Joyce would rewrite Ulysses because some internet wombat said there's not enough story?
All of these books!
Gesturing at the volumes that now litter the floor.
How many do you think would never have been written if the authors gave up because of one man who spends his time writing anonymous essays about ball hair?
That's easy for you to say. I need readers, Claude. I need those scumballs to feed my wife and child. Now everybody who comes to the website to look at my book is going to end up buying a stupid multi-head razor instead.
He rights the chair and flumps down on it. Behind him, in the half-light cast by a fallen lamp, I can see a long dagger of damp blackening the flowery wallpaper. How is the proposal going?
Terribly, he says.
I feel a surge of frustration.
I thought we worked everything out. We have a hero, a heroine, a good idea of the plot. What's the problem?
The problem is writing, Claude. The problem is writing, and writing is the problem. Coming up with an idea is just the entrance ticket into this enormous fucking labyrinth of... Oh, what now?
The door opens and Remington marches in, holding out his sheet to which he has added Ermine Trem in blue crayon.
Dad, my story has a new bit!
That's great, buddy. I'll read it later.
Read it now!
I'll read it when it's finished.
No!
Remington says. Fuck! His father exclaims. He jumps up, goes to the door.
Klitsia! I'm on the phone!
The voice comes back.
For Christ's sake!
Paul says, stamping out to find her.
I'd like to hear your story,
I say to Remington. The boy turns to me seriously.
It's about a boy called Remington,
he says.
And what happens to him?
He goes away with his mama.
I start.
Where does he go?
I say, but before the boy can answer, Klitsia comes into the room. She appears shaken, as though after some tumultuous passage.
Who keeps calling you?
Paul demands, following after her.
The captain of the volleyball team,
she says. Can she take no for an answer?
Klitsia fixes a bleached, perfunctory smile.
Now, little one,
she says to Remington, and she picks him up and carries him out of the room. Paul sinks back in his chair, drapes his wrist over his eyes.
God, I'm so tired,
he says.
Let's get moving with this,
I say, rousing him. Clearly there is more riding on this proposal than money, even if he can't see it.
Where exactly are you stuck?
I'm stuck where I've always been stuck with this damn unintelligible banker. I can't make sense of a single thing he does.
Forget about his job for now. You were right, it's too complicated and will only bore people. Stick with the love story, the girl who rescues him from the bank.
Well, that's just it. Bull pounds his palm on the armchair. Why does he get the girl? What does she see in him?
She sees the person he could be, I begin to say, but that notion so perfect on the sixth floor of Transaction House here seems hollow, pallid, woefully naive.
It's one thing trying to get you a date with a waitress in real life. Bull is pacing back and forth now over the shoals of books. But in a novel, there needs to be some kind of logic. There needs to be some kind of justice. He can't just buy her.
He is not buying her. He is in love with her.
So what? There could be umpteen people in love with her. There could be some sweet, idealistic, totally broke young painter that completely adores her. Why should the banker get her?
Why shouldn't he? I say, feeling a glow of anger rise from my stomach. She redeems him.
How is he redeemed? What does he sacrifice?
Maybe he quits his job.
That's it? He waltzes off into the sunset with his pockets full of money and we're supposed to cheer? That's fucking lame, Claude.
He's never done a good thing for anyone. Give me one reason why he should get the girl too.
Because that's how life is, I snap.
Well, no one wants to read that story, believe me.
You're the expert on what people want to read, I return, but he doesn't hear.
He's storming back and forth, berating himself in the same deranged manner I heard when I came in. Banerjee was right, he is saying. It just can't be done, it just doesn't work anymore.
My anger fades and I feel a pang of guilt. Have I done this to him? Have I infected him and his wife with my own misplaced hopes? Or is there some way forward? Didn't you tell me once, I am embarrassed at the desperation evident in my voice, that at some point in his life everyone finds himself at a crossroads where the clock strikes 13 and he must make a choice who he will be, good or bad? Can't we find that moment for the banker?
Paul looks down at his hands. I have a strange sense of impending dissolution, like an actor at an audition who has delivered his lines and now stares into darkness, waiting for his invisible judges to dismiss him.
What were you saying a minute ago about listening to the market? He says with his head bowed.
I said you shouldn't do it.
No, I think you're onto something. Maybe that's the angle we need to take. Work out what people want and go from there.
Work out what Wombat Willie wants?
He buys books, doesn't he? I've got to make some money from this, Claude. I'm on the fucking ropes here. The whole industry's on the ropes. It isn't the time to be precious.
He kneads his scalp distractedly.
So what is it they want? Strong narratives, right? Exciting stories, characters you remember, drama, violence, murdering prostitutes, a serial killer on the loose, that kind of thing.
That sounds like the kind of stupid scenario the world is already full of.
Well, we can spin it, right? Tweak the formula. The murderer is the detective. The murderer is the narrator. Something like that.
The first thing we need to do is think of a fresh angle.
He brings his fingertips to his temple as if he were trying to tune in a radio.
You said something interesting there about Ulysses not having enough plot. So how about we give it a plot? We use the characters and the basic setup, but with a high-octane 21st century story.
Are you talking about
a sequel to Ulysses?
A feverish light dances in his eyes, sickly sweat burnishing his forehead.
Think about it! It's the most literary book there is, and yet it ends on this completely inconclusive note. That's why for generations readers have been crying out for a follow-up, and now here it is!
He seizes his pen, writes with such a vigour that he tears the page.
It's 10 years after the last book ended. Leopold Bloom is divorced from Molly. He's hit the bottle, he's bitter, he's jaded, he's working as a cop in New York City. A rash of murders has broken out across the city. The killers leave in obscure literary references written on their bodies.
Pornography. The word pops into my mind. I am still hoping he will break off, crack a grin, tell me, gotcha, but on the contrary, it only gets worse.
Jesus, Claude,
I think I've got it. How about this for a twist? When you get to the last page of the book, Bloom goes, I can now reveal the murderer was you. What?
You!
He says again, pointing his finger at my chest, almost beside himself with excitement. Me?
You, like whoever's reading the book. Think about it. Who's the very last person the reader will suspect of committing the crime? Herself, right? Imagine how she's going to feel when the detective says, it was you! And we could have like a 3D finger pointing out of the page.
How can the reader have committed a crime in a fictional world to which she has no access?
That's a minor detail,
he says.
Anyway, why should the reader get off the hook? She's as guilty as anybody, don't you see? This turns the whole crime genre on its head. It'll be huge!
He returns to his scribbling, giggling to himself all the while. He doesn't notice as I slip out of the room. In the kitchen, I find Klitsia placing a bucket under a drip. You have a little leak, I say, though the leak is more of a stream descending steadily from a grey mass in the ceiling.
Oh, this old place,
Klitsia says gaily, then glancing at the bedroom with the same false smile, she says,
he's forgotten about the review.
I think it's given him some interesting new ideas, I say. We both laugh, though I'm not sure why. And you? I inquire. Your ankle, it is better? What? She says, still smiling. When you spoke on the phone earlier to your coach, I thought... Klitsia looks at me uncomprehendingly. Never mind, I say.
Bye-bye, Claude!
Remington, now drawing a large multicolored R, sings from under her feet. Goodbye, my friends, I say in the kindly fashion of the family doctor in a 19th century play. I will see you both very soon, I'm sure. I am halfway down the corridor when she catches up with me.
Frenchman!
I turn, the smile is gone, her fingers are tight around my flesh. He will write the book this time, won't he? What can I tell her? Of course, I say.